Welcome to So Ordered, where we create audio readings of SCOTUS decisions to make them more accessible to the public. At the time of creating this podcast, the Supreme Court of the United States does not release audio of the court's decisions. Our mission is to make it so the public can be better informed on decisions of the court by using AI to generate audio of written opinions. The case before us today is Landor v. Louisiana Department of Corrections and Public Safety, docket number 231197. Decided June 23, 2026. Before reading the opinion itself, here is a brief summary of the case and the questions presented. Damon Landor is a Rastafarian whose religious convictions require him to leave his hair uncut. While serving a sentence in Louisiana, he alleges that prison officers, despite being aware of his religious beliefs, forcibly shaved his head. He brought suit under a federal law known as the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, suing not only the Louisiana Department of Corrections, but also several of its individual officers in their personal capacities, seeking money damages from them. The officers moved to dismiss, arguing that while their employer may have agreed to answer certain private suits under the act, they themselves were not parties to any such agreement. The district court dismissed the claims, and on appeal, the Fifth Circuit declined to revive the claim against the individual officers, holding that the act does not permit suits against officers in their individual capacities. The question presented was whether an individual may sue a government official in his individual capacity for damages for violations of the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. The court held, individuals may not be held liable in their personal capacities under a spending clause statute unless those individuals have voluntarily and knowingly consented to answer lawsuits under the statute. Because the individual defendants in this case did not voluntarily and knowingly consent to face liability in an agreement with the federal government, Mr. Landor's case cannot proceed against them. Justice Gorsuch delivered the opinion of the court, in which Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Thomas, Alito, Kavanaugh, and Barrett joined. Justice Jackson filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justices Sotomayor and Kagan joined. As a reminder, the audio is an AI-generated reading of a published opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States. The voice you will hear has been synthesized to loosely resemble that of the justice that wrote the opinion. All tone, inflection, pacing, and emphasis are produced by the AI model and should not be attributed to any justice. The text itself has been lightly adapted to aid in the creation of the spoken delivery. This is a project to attempt to make court decisions more accessible to the public, and any substantive changes during the reading are completely unintentional. Please visit www.supremecourt.gov to read the opinion published by the court. You can find a link directly to the opinion in this episode's description. As the audio is AI-generated, you may hear some audio glitches, including odd pronunciation, noticeable pauses, or repeated words. We do our best to remove these and hope they do not impact your listening experience. To leave us feedback on the show, or to learn more about the podcast, please visit so-ordered.org. The following is the opinion of the court in Landor v. Louisiana Department of Corrections and Public Safety.
This case concerns whether the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act of 2000 permits plaintiffs to sue non-consenting state employees in their private capacities for damages. Today, Congress offers financial support to all 50 states and many other entities. Much of that support comes with strings attached. So, for example, Congress has conditioned receipt of federal highway funds on a state's agreement to maintain laws setting a minimum drinking age of 21. See South Dakota v. Dole, decided in 1987. Likewise, Congress has conditioned federal Medicaid funds on a state's willingness to administer its health care programs consistent with various rules. See Medina v. Planned Parenthood, South Atlantic, decided in 2025. In each of these contexts and many others, the penalty for noncompliance is straightforward. Congress may terminate funds if a recipient fails to abide by the conditions associated with its grants. The statute at issue before us, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act of 2000, RULUPA, works similarly. As relevant here, RULUPA imposes various conditions on federal funds distributed to state prison systems like the Louisiana Department of Corrections, LDOC. One condition requires prison systems to refrain from imposing substantial burdens on the religious exercises of state prisoners outside exceptional circumstances, If a prison system fails to comply with that condition, Congress may cut off its funding. But when enacting RULUIPA, Congress did something more. It included another, distinct remedy as part of the bargain. As a condition of funding, Congress called on state prison systems to agree to answer suits by private plaintiffs alleging substantial burdens on their religious exercises. Specifically, the law asked those systems to consent to suit by any injured party asserting a violation of RULUIPA and seeking appropriate relief. This case concerns that provision. Damon Landor is a Rastafarian whose religious convictions require him to leave his hair uncut. In 2020, after a conviction in Louisiana State Court, Mr. Landor spent a few months in custody. Near the end of his sentence, as officers transferred him from one facility to another, Mr. Landor grew concerned that the new facility's intake officers might cut his hair pursuant to standard LDOC grooming policies. To avoid that possibility, he provided the officers with a copy of Ware v. LDOC, decided in 2017, which held that RULUIPA generally bars prisons from cutting Rastafarians' hair. But, Mr. Landor says, the LDOC officers in the new facility responded by throwing his copy of Ware in the trash and proceeding to shave his head, causing him to violate his religious beliefs. After that transpired, Mr. Landor brought this lawsuit under RULUIPA seeking money damages. He sued not only LDOC, but also some of the prison system's individual officers in their personal capacities. The officers responded by asking the district court to dismiss Mr. Landor's complaint. As they saw it, their employer, LDOC, may have struck a bargain with the federal government to answer certain private suits by prisoners like Mr. Landor. But, they argued, they were not parties to that or any other agreement to answer private suits under RULUIPA. Accordingly, they continued, Mr. Landor had no federal cause of action against them. Ultimately, the court dismissed Mr. Landor's RULUIPA claims against both LDOC and the officers. On appeal to the Fifth Circuit, Mr. Landor did not challenge the district court's dismissal of his RULUIPA claim against LDOC. Instead, he focused on his claim against the individual officers, asking the Court of Appeals to revive only that portion of his suit. The Fifth Circuit declined to do so. It did not question that RULUIPA may permit certain claims against funding recipients like LDOC, but, the court held, RULUIPA does not permit suits against officers in their individual capacities. We granted Mr. Landor's petition for a writ of certiorari. Before us, the parties dispute two questions. One is whether, by authorizing private lawsuits seeking appropriate relief, RULUIPA ever permits suits for money damages, or whether the statute instead limits plaintiffs like Mr. Landor to other remedies, like injunctions or declaratory judgments. The other question the parties spar over is whether, consistent with the Constitution, a plaintiff may bring a RULUIPA suit against individuals, like the officers in this case, who have not formed any agreement with the federal government. To resolve this case, we need answer only the second question. Article 1 of the Constitution grants Congress certain limited and enumerated powers. Congress, for example, may regulate commerce among the several states. It may establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies. It may coin money and provide for the punishment of counterfeiting. These provisions and others allow Congress to regulate the behavior of the American people in specific fields, and each allows Congress to back up its regulations with a sanction enforced either by the coercion of the magistracy or by the coercion of arms. So, for example, federal statutes require airlines operating in interstate commerce to hold certificates and comply with federal requirements. The bankruptcy code allows a court to alter a creditor's rights and a debtor's responsibilities. Each of these regulations finds its footing in a provision of Article 1 that empowers Congress to do just that, regulate. The terms of RULUIPA before us rest on a different foundation. As the parties agree, Congress enacted them pursuant to what is sometimes called the Constitution's Spending Clause. That provision of Article 1 gives Congress the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. At the founding, some argued this language conferred on Congress the power to regulate on nearly any topic it wishes, backed by practically any sanction it chooses, so long as it does so in service of the general welfare. It appears that Gouverneur Morris, a leading advocate of this reading and a member of the Committee on Style, even tried to replace one of the draft clause's commas with a semicolon with the hope of making his reading more plausible. But a careful proofreader, Roger Sherman, noticed the surreptitious edit, and the convention rejected it. In the end, the founding generation rejected Morris's reading of the clause just as it had his semicolon. While the clause may allow Congress to raise and spend money in support of the general welfare, early authorities concluded, it did not endow Congress with any power to regulate conduct. Were it otherwise, they recognized, the enumeration of specific powers elsewhere in Article I would be rendered largely pointless, and the nation would trade a limited federal government for an unlimited one. This court's precedents have long respected that founding-era consensus. It is an understanding that gives rise to important limitations on spending legislation. Often, Congress attaches conditions to the funds it distributes. And typically, if a recipient violates those conditions, Congress may terminate its agreement to provide funds. But because the spending clause confers no authority to regulate directly, Congress cannot just dictate whatever other sanctions it might wish for violating conditions found in its spending clause legislation. Instead, additional sanctions are permissible only with the voluntary and knowing consent of those who must bear them. Put simply, without independent regulatory authority, Congress must rely on consent. It must ask and others must agree to face liability should they violate a funding condition. Time and time again, from at least 1845 to the present, our precedents have stressed the centrality of consent in this field. Compare Seawright v. Stokes calling spending legislation a compact to which the state assented, with Medina describing spending statutes as federal-state agreements. To sort out whether consent exists, and thus whether a condition associated with spending legislation is enforceable, we have traditionally turned to contract principles for guidance. See Sossaman, holding the contract analogy represents a limitation on the liability spending clause statutes may impose. Consider some examples. At common law, coerced assent to a contract is invalid. Likewise, we have held coerced assent to a spending condition by way of an economic gun to the head is invalid. At common law, ambiguous contractual language is construed against its drafter. Similarly, we have concluded Congress must clearly and unambiguously alert a grant recipient to any condition on federal funds. In these ways and others, our contract analogy helps safeguard against conflating Congress's spending power with a regulatory power. It does so by ensuring that conditions attached to federal funds, including those prescribing exposure to potential sanctions, apply only to those who have knowingly and voluntarily agreed to them. See Cummings noting that an analogy to treaties, another consensual instrument, may also be appropriate. These settled principles resolve this case. Before us, LDOC does not dispute that it is a recipient of federal funds. It does not question that it has agreed to answer certain RULUPA suits as a condition of accepting those funds. But as it comes to us, this case does not involve claims against LDOC. It involves only claims against individuals in their personal capacities. And Mr. Landor does not allege that any of those individuals has entered any agreement with the federal government, let alone that any of them has voluntarily and knowingly consented to answer private suits under RULUPA. To know that is enough to know the Court of Appeals was correct. Mr. Landor does not have a federal RULUPA cause of action against the officers. Under the spending clause, Congress lacks regulatory authority to impose liability on them directly and must depend instead on consent. and because they never agreed to answer suits like this one, Mr. Landor's case cannot proceed against them any more than a breach of contract action might proceed against a defendant who never formed a contract. Seeking to avoid this conclusion, Mr. Landor and the dissent advance many arguments, but each is a variation on the same theme. In different ways, Mr. Landor and the dissent submit, the lack of voluntary and knowing consent does not matter, and each of their arguments fails for exactly that reason. Under the spending clause and our precedents, voluntary and knowing consent is key. Mr. Landor begins by invoking agency in contract law. As LDOC's agents, he contends, the individual defendants have a duty to obey all reasonable directions from their principal. And, he adds, an agent's actions can sometimes bind his principal to a contract when he acts within the scope of his authority. From these common law principles, Mr. Landor reasons, it follows that the individual defendants in this case may be held personally liable under RLUIPA. That much does not follow even from the precepts Mr. Landor cites. Certainly, an agent usually must obey his principal's directions and sometimes may bind his principal. But when a principal, here, LDOC, enters a contract with a third party, here, the federal government, as a matter of black-letter contract law, the principal's agents do not become liable to the third party for their principal's non-performance. The agent cannot enforce the principal's contract, nor is the agent bound by it. It is too clear to be controverted that contracts made on account of the government are obligatory on the government, not the government's officer. So, yes, LDOC might be subject to certain private suits under RLUIPA for breaching its promises to the federal government. But under normal principles of agency and contract law, that does not mean LDOC's employees are as well. To be sure, Mr. Landor and the dissent identify ways in which Congress could have lawfully imposed personal liability on the individual defendants. For example, Congress could have said that, as a condition of federal funding to LDOC, its officers had to agree to enter separate contracts with the federal government consenting to answer suits under RLUIPA. Or Congress might have conditioned its funds on Louisiana's agreement to exercise its own regulatory powers to adopt a state law cause of action enforceable against LDOC officers who violate RLUIPA. But these untapped possibilities only underscore Mr. Landor's bind. The first hypothetical has what this case does not, namely, an agreement between the federal government and the defendants. And in the second hypothetical, again unlike this case, the state would have exercised its own regulatory powers. See Randolph B. Donaldson describing a Virginia statute that did essentially that in response to a federal request. Next, Mr. Landor points to Dole. That case, he says, set out just four requirements for spending clause legislation, and consent is not among them. As he reads Dole, a condition on the grant of federal funds need only be in pursuit of the general welfare, unambiguously expressed, related to the federal interest in particular national projects or programs, and not in violation of other constitutional provisions. And because a condition requiring non-consenting individuals to answer RLUIPA suits satisfies all these requirements, Mr. Landor concludes, his case may proceed. The dissent appears to agree, suggesting that the voluntary and knowing consent requirement finds no support in any of Dole's prongs. That is incorrect. The four rules Mr. Landor extracts from Dole apply in addition to, not instead of, the rule that Congress may not use the spending clause to bind entities and individuals without their knowing and voluntary consent. That much is evident from Dole itself. As the dissent admits, Dole proceeds to add a fifth rule for spending clause legislation shortly after the passage. Mr. Landor cites, funding conditions may not pass the point at which pressure turns into compulsion. And that bar on compulsion, as we have seen, serves to help ensure real consent exists. The same holds true of the clear statement rule that Dole reaffirmed. Congress must impose spending conditions unambiguously, not for no reason. but so that participants in federally funded programs may exercise their choice knowingly, cognizant of the consequences of their participation. Had Dole meant to bulldoze the consent requirement and condone consent-free regulation under the spending clause, it would have had no occasion to emphasize any of this. Nor does Mr. Landor's and the dissent's consent-free gloss on Dole merely overlook important qualifications in Dole itself. Worse still, their misreading would pit that decision against nearly two centuries' worth of cases recognizing the consent requirement, hardly a sensible way to construe our precedents. Responding to these problems, Mr. Landor and the dissent submit that RULUIPA's mere existence sufficed to alert the individual defendants, or at least their employer, that they could be held personally liable. But, just like the attempt to rewrite Dole, this argument misses the point. A spending clause statute does not carry independent regulatory force. It assumes binding effect only through voluntary and knowing agreement. If someone has not agreed to be bound, it does not matter that he may be aware of the existence of a contract between other parties. And if someone has not agreed to be bound, it does not matter whether other contracting parties might wish to bind him. Either way, he has not agreed to be bound, so he cannot be. Seeking still another way around the consent requirement, Mr. Landor turns next to the fungibility of money. The individual defendants, he observes, receive paychecks from LDOC, and some of that entity's funding comes from the federal government. As a result, Mr. Landor submits, the individual defendants are indirect recipients of federal funds and, for that reason, should be deemed to have implicitly consented to RULUIPA liability. This submission fails as well. Mr. Landor would have us hold, for the first time, that so long as a penny of federal spending makes its way to an individual, however indirectly, Congress can regulate his conduct directly based on the fiction that he has consented to regulation. None of that is consistent with our precedents holding that funding conditions in spending clause legislation lack independent regulatory force, but instead derive their effect from voluntary and knowing assent. Notice, too, where Mr. Landor's theory would lead. Given the explosion of spending clause legislation in recent decades, Congress would enjoy an effectively unbridled police power. Federal authorities would have no need to show that their regulations represent proper exercises of Congress's limited and enumerated powers found in the Commerce Clause, the Bankruptcy Clause, or any other. All they would have to show is that a recipient who consented to a funding condition spent some formerly federal money in transactions with a third party. Just like that, the federal government could directly regulate the third party's conduct. Take some examples. On Mr. Landor's theory, Congress could require coaches at universities that receive federal funds to permit transgender athletes to play women's sports or face personal liability in suits for damages. Likewise, Congress could bar doctors at medical practices that accept federal funds from administering certain vaccines to children, again on pain of damages. None of that fits with our system of limited and enumerated federal powers, where all others are reserved to the states and the people. The dissent criticizes us for trotting out this parade of horribles. But if this is a parade, the dissent marches right along, embracing these hypotheticals and more. In fact, as the dissent sees it, we should not engage in hair-splitting over any strict direct consent to liability requirement or ill-formed contract analogy. On its view, these things are all just empty formalisms. If Congress can ask individuals to consent to funding conditions, or ask states to enact laws in order to receive federal funds, Congress might as well be allowed to regulate private behavior directly. Likely enough, that vision would have delighted Governor Morris. But it is one at war with the terms of the spending clause, how that clause has been widely understood since the founding, and a long line of this court's precedents. Nor is there anything empty about insisting that Congress operate within the limited and enumerated powers the Constitution provides. This court has rejected views like the dissent's many times before. and we do so again today. Faced with that problem, Mr. Landor and the dissent search for some foothold in our precedents to support their view that the spending clause grants Congress direct regulatory authority. Perhaps the best they can muster is a line snipped from Rust B. Sullivan, decided in 1991, where we said that an individual employed in a federally funded program must perform his duties in accordance with the restrictions specified by Congress. But even that is of no help. Rust did not involve an attempt to impose personal liability on the program's employees. The only consequence for violating Congress's funding conditions fell on the federal funding recipient itself and amounted to no more than a loss of funding. And that is exactly the typical remedy for non-compliance our cases have long described. Mr. Landor and the dissent also point to Grove City College v. Bell, decided in 1984, a Title IX case. But there, too, the only penalty was the traditional one, the termination of federal funding. Subsequent events illustrate as much. After losing the case, the college decided to exit the federal funding programs rather than surrender its autonomy, a choice it was free to make because Title IX binds only those who have freely elected to accept federal funds. Pretty plainly, neither Rust nor Grove City College purported to reimagine the spending clause's terms or to rewrite our precedents construing them. Finding our precedents under the spending clause unavailing, Mr. Landor and the dissent appeal to ones construing the necessary and proper clause. In Sabry v. United States, decided in 2004, we held that Congress's criminal ban on theft, fraud, or bribery against a federal funding recipient, Title 18 United States Code, Section 666, is a necessary and proper incident to Congress's authority under the spending clause. Mr. Landor and the dissent contend this case is no different because personal liability for non-consenting defendants is likewise a necessary and proper incident to RULUIPA's policy protecting religious exercises. Much as the other arguments we have encountered misconceive the spending clause, this one misunderstands the necessary and proper clause. The latter provision authorizes Congress to employ necessary and proper means for carrying into execution its other enumerated powers. Put another way, the clause allows Congress to enact laws incidental to those powers which are expressly given. So the question is not, as Mr. Landor in the dissent would have it, whether a personal capacity cause of action is incidental to RULUIPA's policy protecting religious exercises. The question, instead, is whether their proposed cause of action is a necessary and proper incident to Congress's constitutionally enumerated power to spend money. With the question correctly framed, the distinction between this case and Sabry becomes unmistakable. Section 666 addresses thieves, fraudsters, bribers, and others who threaten to fritter away and graft the funds Congress distributes pursuant to the spending clause. The thief steals allocated money. The fraudster extracts it under false pretenses. The briber obtains it by greasing palms. Congress, Sabry held, does not have to sit by and accept the risk actors of that sort posed to its constitutionally enumerated spending power. Instead, as a necessary and proper incident to that power, Congress may punish people who seek to sap federal funds from their intended beneficiaries. And Congress may do so, Sabry concluded, even where not every misappropriated dollar may be traceable to specific federal payments. Nothing similar can be said for the cause of action Mr. Landor and the dissent propose. Suits against non-consenting parties, like the individual officers here, might advance RULUIPA, laudable policy of protecting religious exercises. But they do not safeguard from graft the federal funds Congress distributes pursuant to its spending power. Recognizing as much, seemingly every court of appeals to address the question has concluded that Sabry does not begin to command the result Mr. Landor and the dissent seek. Nor, with Sabry out of the picture, can Mr. Landor and the dissent explain how their proposed cause of action would help carry into execution Congress's enumerated power to spend money. In truth, they don't even try. Instead, they suggest, the necessary and proper clause ought to be elastic enough to allow the extraction of money damages from virtually anyone who violates virtually any condition found in spending clause legislation. But while the necessary and proper clause may allow Congress to enact provisions actually incidental to its spending power, like those protecting federal money against graft, it does not tolerate outcomes that would undermine the structure of the federal government established by the Constitution. Nor does the clause tolerate results that would violate the principle of state sovereignty. And adopting the expansive approach Mr. Landor and the dissent propose would require us to violate both rules. Just consider what they would have us say. On their view, Congress may evade the consent requirement inherent in its spending clause authority simply by invoking the necessary and proper clause. With even a modest federal expenditure somewhere nearby, Congress could then proceed to regulate directly the conduct of countless non-consenting individuals, not just the individual officers here, but also others like the coaches and physicians we discussed above. Congress could regulate directly, too, in innumerable spheres, including ones traditionally reserved to the states. Really, under Mr. Landor's and the dissent's logic, we would be hard-pressed to posit any activity that Congress would be without power to regulate, and as inconsistent as all that is with both principles of state sovereignty and a federal government of limited and enumerated regulatory powers, it hardly represents a proper means for carrying into execution Congress's spending power. Under the spending clause, Congress's power to spend money does not include the power to regulate. Spending clause statutes can bind only those who voluntarily and knowingly undertake obligations by agreement with the federal government. Because that essential element is missing here, we affirm the judgment of the Fifth Circuit. It is so ordered.